Welcome to Interventions. We're glad to have you back. My name is Amira Möding.
And I'm Michael Kredovich.
It is our pleasure to welcome Teresa Bejan for this episode of Interventions. Teresa is a renowned and widely published historian of political thought and intellectual history and a political theorist. Teresa is a professor of political theory and a fellow of Oriel College at Oxford. Her monograph on mere civility and the limits of toleration was published in 2017 with Harvard University Press. She has published a special forum with Modern Intellectual History, edited together with Sophie Smith and Annette Zimmermann, on Rawls, and published articles on freedom of speech, what we can learn from the Quakers about the use of pronouns, and the limits of public discourse. In her current work, she engages the concept of equality in the 17th century and how it was used by leveler activists, titled First Among Equals, The Practice and Theory of Early Modern Equality. This is forthcoming with Harvard University Press also. Teresa, thank you. We are glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's really exciting to be here.
To get us started, could you say something about how and when your interest in the history of political thought began and which texts or people and research contexts most shaped your perspective?
Part of my intellectual formation was here at Cambridge, so it's always really exciting to be back. But I would say that my love of the history of political thought really dates back to the first class and the first teacher I had at the University of Chicago as an undergraduate. So my professor was Eric McGilvray, who now teaches at Ohio State University. And he was charged with teaching the first year core course on classics of social and political thought. And it was just utterly transformative for me. I mean, it was the magic of Eric as a teacher. He was just full of joy and enthusiasm. And then also the particular other students in my class. It just was this wonderful collection of people who got really excited about books and then became friends on the basis of those books. And after that, I was just really hooked. So at Chicago, I ended up doing effectively a great books degree. It's called Fundamentals, Issues, and Texts. And I sort of realized subsequently that it was a Straussian program. But I had really wonderful professors in that program, Nathan Tarkoff, James Redfield, Ralph Lerner, Herman Sinaiko. And it just really encouraged me still with that sense of studying very good books as something worthwhile and something, as itself a kind of creative activity. And the natural thing to do, obviously, as a kind of unknowing Straussian at the University of Chicago was to come to Cambridge to work with Quentin Skinner, which is, of course, exactly what I did. It made perfect sense. I think I was saying to Amira before we started recording, I regard myself as a kind of accidental early modernist, because when I came to Cambridge, I ended up being supervised by Quentin initially, and then by John Donne, and finally by Mark Goldie. And you know, how could you not really fall in love with the 17th century under such supervision? And so there, I think I really encountered an entirely new way of thinking about these texts and thinking about politics. And from there, I think I, continued to sort of pursue my middle path, not quite a Straussian, not quite a Skinnerian, but sort of doing something that we might call political theory.
I just wanted to ask you, what is it about the 17th century for you? What drew you in? What got you?
Oh, I mean, it's such an interesting question because I have what I think are answers. All of this is retrospective, but I think I really liked Locke. I read Locke and I was like, I like this guy. It's funny now, I continue to work on Locke, but certainly I've published a lot more in the intervening years on Hobbes, but my master's dissertation was originally on Milton, and I was just very moved, I think, by the power of the prose and the pressingness of the problems as being familiar in some ways and yet utterly foreign. So I don't know, I guess I found the 17th century as being the sort of sweet spot of historical distance for me to be able to kind of imaginatively inhabit the world, but not just, domesticate it to my own world.
sufficiently strange.
Yeah, exactly. Sufficiently strange. It's nice.
We might move then to your first book on mere civility. Now, you've been interviewed at length on this, so what I'd like to do is connect it to your more recent work. So my question is, you've pointed to mere civility, the virtue of being honest with your opponents and not being nice to them while remaining in the debate, as a key virtue of tolerant societies. Equality might also be a concept at the heart of tolerant or democratic societies, at least as we understand them today. Do you think that both are linked? Do I have to understand my opponent, at least in some minimal form, as my equal to practice civility?
So I think it's a very natural thought to think that civility and equality are linked. And in fact, when I started writing my PhD dissertation, which became the basis of the book, that was one of the kind of governing assumptions in the literature that I would see, that civility was, of course, about recognizing others as equals, respecting them as equals, etc. But part of what sort of motivated me then in writing the book was the thought that, no, that's wrong. Civility is about a lot of things, and it may, in some societies, be about a kind of recognition of equal standing. But civility is fundamentally about recognizing and maintaining social hierarchies. That's a lot of the work that it does as a conversational virtue. And I don't think anything is gained by sort of speciously egalitarianizing things like civility. In the book, I write about a tendency in political theory that I describe as the reductio ad respectum, that turns every good thing in social and political life into a form of respect for persons. And I just think that, you know, look, virtues like civility are virtues. Nevertheless, we need to really get to grips with what they are and what they aren't without suddenly sort of just assuming that everything we like will go together. And I would say that the kind of the skepticism maybe of the egalitarian nature of civility in my first book is more or less what drove me then to think that I would like to write directly on equality for the second book, because I realized I just didn't understand equality. And I think I've now confirmed to myself that I do not understand equality. So that's the experience of writing the second book.
You suggest in a variety of articles on free speech that we can learn from the ancients and their conceptual finesse. You argue, for example, that we can better understand some normative claims of feminist philosophy through the concept of isagoria. Could you say more about what we can learn from isagoria in particular, and how and what we can learn from history and maybe lost or marginalized concepts and traditions?
You know, look, as I've said, I'm an accidental early modernist, and I'm an enthusiastic amateur when it comes to ancient political thought. But certainly, as someone who thinks about free speech and cares about free speech, I have learned a lot from looking at the history of ideas of free speech, and specifically this ancient Greek distinction that you allude to between parrhasia, which we might think of as free speech in the sense of speaking frankly without fear or favor, and a sense of free or really equal speech called isagoria, which is the sort of equal right of Athenian men to address the democratic assembly. And both of these terms get translated indifferently in modern English translations as free speech, but they're actually very, very different. And so for me, as again, a kind of, you know, just enthusiastic amateur, I got really interested in the idea, oh, wait, there are actually very different and important conceptual distinctions that are completely lost through the act of translation. So it certainly has helped my own thinking to try to then go back to sort of to understand that older view of thinking of these as two different things and not the same thing. And having done that, I thought, oh, well, actually, this helps me understand much better what's at stake in so many contemporary controversies about free speech. There's actually a disagreement about the nature of free speech. Is it about that kind of, you know, the liberty to offend? Or is it about recognizing everyone as having a voice and having that voice count? And I think these are both really important values, but they're not the same value. My work on free speech is interesting insofar as this Greek distinction that I've now, you know, published a few pieces on, actually, you know, that began as an article in the Atlantic. So it was a public-facing article, and I just thought, well, you know, this ancient Greek distinction has helped me make sense of what's going on. I wonder if it'll help other people. And, you know, it was one of my sort of biggest accomplishments, I think, pitching a piece to the Atlantic on the basis of a distinction in Attic Greek that they then publish. But in any case, for me, that was proof of concept that actually you can do quite a lot with the history of ideas. So going back to the sort of bigger methodological question, I would say, I think that what historical perspectives offer us, actually going back to, Michael, to your observation about sufficient strangeness, it facilitates a kind of alienation in two senses. So an alienation from the contemporary commitments and particularly partisan identities that structure so many of our contemporary political disputes. So if you're looking at, you know, a disagreement between Parrhasia and Isagoria in ancient Athens, people don't have the same strong dynamics of believing and belonging about who's right that they might bring to a kind of contemporary controversy. But then there's also an element of kind of conceptual alienation or just the defamiliarization of ideas that we take for granted. And again, this phenomenon, which I've already alluded to, where, you know, seemingly obvious and familiar ideas, in fact, once you look just a bit more closely, are, you know, they carry their histories with them. And especially, you know, ancient and honorable ideas like the freedom of speech, I mean, that has a long history, and so many values and ideas have been sort of carried under that banner over time. And so I think that looking to the past allows us to isolate, disaggregate particular claims and commitments that in retrospect just get sort of lumped under this one label. And I don't think that that then tells us what the right way to think about the, you know, so what the right answer is, but I think it does help us think more clearly, and I think it helps us disagree better.
In your writings on Rawls, you are, among other things, concerned with how he creates a political philosophy tradition as a historical and ongoing tradition, or earlier in his works, traditions, so plural. Moreover, you take him to normatively close this tradition through a teleology that has Western, or specifically even US democracy, as its highest form, at least for now. How did you become interested in Rawls' take on what political philosophy is?
I mean, so the true answer to your question about sort of how I got interested in this is, again, that it was an accident to biography. So I had pretty much made it through my PhD at Yale without reading any Rawls. You know, I ended up getting my first job at the University of Toronto, and then after that I moved to Oxford, and one doesn't become a professor of political theory at Oxford without reading a lot of Rawls and reading him really closely. And so it was at Oxford that I really was first introduced in a sustained way, because I had to teach it, to a kind of analytic political philosophy that has a major debt to Rawls, and for which a theory of justice is much more of a canonical text than Hobbes's Leviathan or Plato's Republic. And so for me, coming again from this great books background, that was just immediately legible to me. I was like, oh, right, this is a great book. We're going to read it closely, and then we're going to defend it. You know? But I realized that response to it was less than intuitive, I think, to some of my colleagues. In particular, the historian's response is like, oh, this is a great book. Let me historicize it. Right? So that I encountered, not a lot, but I think some pushback. And it was that experience then of trying to work out sort of, given that Rawls was just as dead as Hobbes or Hegel, what would be the right way to approach that text? Again, thinking about that as a teacher of the text. So that was, I think, the germ of the idea behind what became the historical Rawls Conference in 2017, and then was the basis of this special issue for modern intellectual history. And look, I mean, I'm not a scholar of Rawls in the way that Katrina Forrester is, or even Sophie Smith. You know, for me, it was more of an occasional interest. And as you say, it was precisely this interest in political theory or philosophy as itself being the product of a tradition, and thinking about the identity of that tradition as it looks in different places. So you see, over the course of my career, I sort of started out Chicago, moved to Cambridge, did my PhD at Yale, taught at Toronto. Every department I've been in has understood political theory to be something totally different and constituted by a totally different set of, you know, methodologies and texts. And so the question I wanted to ask Rawls and sort of put to him in that paper was, well, you know, how would Rawls teach John Rawls? as a figure in the history of political thought. And, you know, spoiler alert, he actually thinks a lot about that because he was constantly teaching himself as the sort of keystone text in his own moral and political philosophy surveys.
So the liberal, if you will, tradition Rawls defends has clear blind spots and limits that I believe link to your work on equality and even civility. Could you speak on where those limits come from and if they are linked to how Rawls sets up the history of political philosophy? And also, could you maybe comment on if you take these blind spots to be actually blind spots or, you know, maybe constitutive of Rawls' philosophy?
It's interesting. You know, I don't, in my current work, I'm quite hard on the idea of blind spots because I think that many of the things that get classified as blind spots in the history of political thought, for instance, forms of exclusion, persistent hierarchies, sexist hierarchies, racist hierarchies, etc., are not seen. They're in fact there and they're sort of theorized explicitly. It's just that from the perspective of the present, we don't like to think about these commitments as being thought through or defended. I mean, as you say, I see them as constitutive rather than incidental. And I think the blind spot locution sort of says, oh, there are these unfortunate kind of lacunae that we can then, you know, forgive, explain, apologize for, and then get on with it. I mean, with Rawls, so much of what strikes me in reading Rawls, and of course this is, you know, what strikes a historian of political thought reading Rawls, is precisely how much the normative political theory is structured by a philosophy of history that sees, you know, the United States under the Warren Court as effectively the telos of the tradition of political philosophy. I remember giving a paper about Rawls once to an audience that was sort of political theorists, philosophers mainly, and making the observation about the Warren Court, and one of my very sort of esteemed not Oxford colleague, but colleague in the discipline, saying, "I don't know what the Warren Court is. Is that a problem?" You know, this is someone who sort of published reams and reams on Rawls over his very eminent career, and I said, "Yes, I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem because I don't think you can make sense of how the political theory works." For Rawls, and especially for someone like Ronald Dworkin, without thinking about the Supreme Court as a sort of putative agent of progressive justice.
So from one philosopher who thought a lot about teaching himself to another, Thomas Hobbes, a few questions on this. Hobbes used memorable metaphoric images to communicate the main points of his civil doctrine, the mortal God, Leviathan, and the secular hell of the state of nature. These images still impress us today. You've written at some length about Hobbes's program of civic education. Could you tell us about his program, why he thought it was needed, and what effects its metaphors were meant to have?
It's wonderful to have this question following on the previous, because you're right that I think this interest in education has been the sort of one of the key sort of through lines in my work. And my very first publication ever was on Hobbes's arguments about education reform in Leviathan. And I think, you know, in terms of stories, it's just worth noting that the reason I wrote that article was because Quentin Skinner had been invited to contribute an essay on Hobbes on education and was too busy. And he seemed to remember that I had written my MPhil thesis on education, but to forget that I'd written it on Milton and not on Hobbes. But I wasn't going to remind him. So again, going back to happy accidents, I think that my passion for Hobbes really came out of that article and really being dazzled by the ambition of his educational reform project, which I tried to situate in terms of contemporary educational reform movements, spearheaded by Samuel Hartlib and others. But effectively, what I see Hobbes as doing in Leviathan is trying to initiate an absolutely comprehensive and revolutionary system of civic education in the Commonwealth that's going to operate on all levels. Most famously in the university, so he thinks that they should be teaching Leviathan. But I think what people don't notice is that, in fact, he has a whole plan for how the doctrine of Leviathan is going to be disseminated to those who don't have the time or inclination or ability to actually read the text themselves. And in that article, I'm responding to people like Jeremy Waldron, who had written these wonderful essays, but basically making the case for, Hobbes is very interested in education. This means he's a public reason liberal. And, my response being, if you look, Hobbes is really interested in how you can utilize the existing clerical apparatus in order to get basically ministers to preach Leviathan from the pulpit every Sunday, as opposed to their own dodgy political opinions. And as you say, Michael, a big part of this then is thinking about the images in Leviathan as fundamentally educative. My favorite example is the natural condition of mankind in chapter 13 as a kind of secular hell, which is going to take the place of the other place when it comes to these sermons. Another example is the trying to reduce the laws of nature to the Ten Commandments. I mean, there's lots of that in there. And so, again, I like to point to the bits of a thinker that don't necessarily fit what we think he should be saying when we think, Hobbes cares about education because he cares that people obey willingly and rationally.
Reading your accounts of the debates over the state of the universities in 17th century England, it is striking that what we call academic freedom doesn't register as a concern. Participants from across the spectrum of political opinion agreed, and this is their metaphor, that the waters of learning had turned foul and needed to be purified. Today, many political theorists would balk at the idea that they sprinkle knowledge upon their students in the manner of a priest at the baptismal font. Purity and academic freedom, then, do not sit easily together. Has the time come for a defense of the impure university?
What an interesting question. It's not something I've thought a lot about in terms of purity, but I think you're right that certainly one of the many kind of parallels between the present day and the 17th century that strikes me is this parallel of controversies over higher education. There's nothing new under the sun. We're very, very concerned about what the universities are teaching and how they're teaching it. The digger mystic Jared Winstanley referred to Oxford and Cambridge as standing ponds of stinking water, which is a great metaphor, and precisely then implies that what needs to be done is to purify the doctrine that's taught. And I think that, again, it's maybe an intuitive thought to say, in order to reform the universities, we've got to understand fundamentally what they're for. And we have sometimes very aspirational, high-minded ideals of what a university is for. I mean, you hear things about the pursuit of truth, pursuit of wisdom. Increasingly, you hear the pursuit of justice. But then you also have the more prosaic realities where universities are effectively sort of the chief credentializing instrument in societies, and effectively what they do is credential elites. And I suppose, in keeping with my proclivities, I would want to say, look, maybe what we need to think more clearly about is not maybe the purity of purpose of the university, but the plurality of purposes, right? Universities are doing a lot of different things at different times. And as we think about what the guiding and governing ideals should be, we should also be forthright about the social power of these institutions. But I would say, there's one thing that I think universities don't do and shouldn't do. certainly don't do, probably shouldn't do, is educate young people to be good citizens. This is sometimes what you hear from defenders of the humanities in the United States, that basically what the humanistic university instruction does is provide civic education, and I just think that is wrong. Worse than that, it's a losing argument. So we should stop making it.
Is the concern there partly from the fact that if we were to be serious about university as civic education, it would probably look something much more like what Hobbes had in mind?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we go back to sort of academic freedom in the back door. I mean, I care. I care about academic freedom. But I also think that, again, this goes back to just my formative experiences at the University of Chicago, that the excitement of studying the humanities and particularly studying the tradition of the history of political thought is precisely all the ways in which those texts challenge the foundations of democracy, challenge the idea of equality, challenge all of these things that we take to be absolutely fundamental to liberal democracy as a regime.
On this theme of texts that challenge us, a recent guest of the podcast observed that in studying historical texts, we engage with the authors in a centuries-long process of clarifying our terms. After Mere Civility, your work has turned to equality. Many political theorists speak about this concept from the God's eye view. Yet you suggest, I think, that that is not true clarity. The partial and human perspective offered by history gives counterintuitively the clearer view. What does the political theorist's high-altitude analysis miss, at least when it comes to inequality?
Well, I think this is especially clear with the concept of equality, because what you see in political theory and political philosophy, treatments of equality, and specifically what they call basic equality, which is the idea of every person having intrinsic worth or having a sort of fundamentally shared status, is that that scholars are seduced by the term equality itself because of its mathematical resonances, its connotations of transcendent truth. Dworkin, Dworkin constantly is talking about the axiomatic nature of basic equality as a premise of political argument. And again, that geometric metaphor is really telling. So I think equality is rhetorically very persuasive as an idea. Deal, and that helps to explain the remarkable concept creep with respect to equality. Again, I was talking about respect earlier, where sort of every good thing suddenly gets bundled under that same label, that one concept. And certainly, we've talked about this already, but I find approaching the concept of equality historically really helpful then for undoing that concept creep and trying to disaggregate the various conceptual relations that end up getting bundled eventually under the one label of equality. So in the book, I talk about how equality expresses an ideal of balance in ancient political thought and also in early modern political thought. So political equality is fundamentally about balancing the parts of the body politic. It's not about giving everyone a strictly equal number of rights. That's emphatically not what it's about. Or thinking about equality in the Roman law and later in Christian theology is about being about the indifference of an authoritative perspective. So from the perspective of God or the law, all of the differences between us as individuals are as matters of indifference, right? We don't take them into account. And then finally, this idea of equality as a kind of socially inflected or socially situated in a evaluative relation of parity. So the idea that actually equality is about me recognizing you as an equal, by which I mean a peer, someone who sort of matches me in virtue or value. And that sense of equality, I think, is really crucial for a lot of arguments that we would think of today as relational egalitarian arguments. So people like Elizabeth Anderson, I think they're really drawing on this idea of equality as parity, which is developed by the Levellers in the 17th century. So that's, again, what I hope to be doing. I mean, also in your question was a point about the sort of the first person perspective. I suppose the other thing I find attractive about approaching these questions historically is because then we can look at what people did on the basis of these ideas. So thinking about equality is something we do, right? Okay, well, what did people do in the name of equality? And again, you'll find they don't do the things that you think that they should do. And there, again, I just think, you know, that can help us see a lot more clearly about what equality might mean or what it might not mean.
In your lecture, First Among Equals, held at Princeton in the James Madison series in March last year, you note that you have become less interested in the interventions made by the big philosophers of the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes, for example. Instead, you have written about Mary Astle, John Lilburn, and Gerard Winston Lee, activists whose writings historians of political thought tend to overlook. So the first question here is, what can we learn from them that we can't get from Hobbes? So what do we learn from the activists? Do they cast Hobbes in a different light? One cue here would be you're writing about parity as a concept worth reviving.
I should say I'm still interested in Hobbes. I'm still interested in the great works of political philosophy, and I think we should continue to employ people like me and potentially yourselves to teach them. Put that out there. But I think one of the things that we do gain from looking at these more marginal figures is precisely because I do think they can help us see parts of the great philosophers that we've missed. So, for instance, I've published an article on the hats in the frontispiece to Hobbes's Leviathan, which, you know, you might not notice if you're not aware of controversies over hat honor in the late 1640s about people refusing to doff and don their hats to authority figures. So that kind of thing. That was, you know, the leveler's calling card and also something that the diggers did. And eventually, I mean, the Quakers made, you know, a tenet of their religion that they wouldn't take their hats off to anyone. So there's that. I think there is, you know, studying the more marginal figures, this is just a good Cambridge School point, studying the more marginal figures can improve our understanding of those sort of big books that we keep talking about. But I also think part of what drives my interest in these figures is just a kind of personal sympathy with the sort of wacky ones, the people who don't quite fit. You know, maybe go back to that autobiographical sense of being somewhere between Chicago and Cambridge. I think that there's a tendency maybe for historians of political thought to want to consider only the arguments we recognize as good arguments rather than the arguments that were persuasive and understand the reason that those were persuasive. I mean, we care about persuasion insofar as we talk about rhetoric. You know, we talk about the power of different rhetorical languages or forms or whatever, but I'm really interested in the arguments made by unexpected people, and particularly the leveler arguments in the latter part of the 1640s, which become really oddly persuasive and get taken up by lots of people who are in no way themselves levelers. And finally, I just say, you know, in terms of the sort of the rogues gallery of people that I write on, I mean, you might say that Lilburn and Mary Astle don't have much in common, but certainly what they have in common maybe is a resistance to thinking the things that people think they should. And I find that very, very sympathetic.
Just, you know, all of what you said really also reminds me on your work on civility and the question of, you know, disagreeability and disagreement and the question of, you know, how do we, and I mean, that also ties back maybe to the role that humanities do have, is the question of should we maybe in the humanities teach that, you know, disagreeable people are still worth listening to?
Yes, absolutely. You're preaching to the converted. I think the main insight, you know, if I claim to have any insights about civility, I think is one I take from Hobbes, which is that, look, disagreement is disagreeable. That's just a fact. You know, the negative effective dimension of disagreement is inevitable and perpetual. And so what we need to do is not sort of imagine a form of disagreement in which that disagreeableness is eliminated, but rather come up with strategies for managing it. Mm-hmm. Civility is one such strategy. But certainly I am conscious in my own life, my personal life, my professional life, and my teaching life, of really seeing my role as you know, about cultivating my own tolerance of the disagreeableness of disagreement, and maybe hopefully imparting that to others. You know, and again, there are different strategies one might employ, but I would say certainly I think that's a kind of, once again, unifying commitment throughout my work.
I have a question about, you mentioned bringing Astle and Lilburn together is unexpected. So I wonder...
They wouldn't like it.
And I wonder if I can ask what you're doing historiographically by drawing these figures together. So taking a high toy like Astel and Lil Benalevla under the heading of equality, you certainly distinguish yourself from, well, one of the much better known accounts of this period and the ideas of this period, the Marxisant account of England's 17th century. So where do you sit there?
Certainly I see myself as engaging critically with that historiography. But, you know, plenty of people have engaged critically with that historiography. For me, I think it's more, I'm really inspired by that historiography because I think that it really captures something exciting and important about this moment in the history of political thought. It does that very well. What it does less well, I think, is the sorts of things we've been talking about, capturing the variety, capturing the disagreeable bits, capturing the things that don't quite go together in the way that we might hope. And so you might say what I'm offering is a kind of friendly corrective. But also I am trying to subvert, I think, many of the stories that we continue to tell ourselves about sort of, to take Astel again, you know, the way that we work to integrate these more marginal figures into the history of political thought is by situating them vis-a-vis one of the canonical figures. Often, so with Astel, she becomes a feminist critic of John Locke. That's the way she gets incorporated. The Diggers get incorporated as kind of communist critics of John Locke, although it doesn't quite work historically. You know, this sort of thing. And again, I just want to say, no, they're more than that. The thought itself is really peculiar and interesting and worth engaging with, not simply in the shadow of these great guys.
So in the paper you will present today, you point to different ways of narrating equality. You call one descriptive. It says that the state of humanity is one of natural equality. You call the other prescriptive. If humanity were to follow godly reason, they should organize as equals. Could you speak to the rhetorical and normative force of these argumentative strategies? How does the outlook of the different proponents of equality impact their respective conceptions of equality?
So I think I might prefer normative to prescriptive. I think very often this is a distinction that gets conflated or missed out in contemporary political theoretical debates about equality. And what I mentioned earlier, this idea of basic equality. So the idea that every person is somehow equal with respect to worth or status. It's both a descriptive claim and a normative claim. We are, in fact, equal. Therefore, we should be treated as equals. And Jeremy Waldron, for instance, is very emphatic that you can't have the normative claim without the descriptive ground or foundation. Now, people like Ann Phillips have pushed back on this to say, you know, if I don't have to offer a justification for the fact that we should be treating one another as equals. And I'm very sympathetic to Anne's argument, which I think is actually sort of calling back to an Arendtian tradition of thinking about equality as a matter of commitment rather than a matter of argument. In the book I talk about, and I think I've mentioned it already, this idea of thinking about equality as something we do rather than something that we argue for. That being said, though, I find the descriptive claim less compelling than I find the normative claim. So there I would say I am much more in sympathy with the kind of the Phillips or Rent position. But where I depart, I guess, is that I have a much stronger sense of the persistence and indeed the necessity of hierarchy in order to make relating as equals possible. And that, I think, is something that has just not really been taken sufficiently seriously by normative theorists and analytic egalitarians. There's some movement. My colleague Joe Wolfe at Oxford has written a bit about why egalitarians need to care about hierarchy. But certainly the relational egalitarian instinct that what the point of equality is, so this is what Elizabeth Anderson argues, the point of equality is to reject hierarchy. I just think that doesn't work. Some hierarchies, maybe. but not others. In fact, it sort of relies on other hierarchies that are constitutive.
Thank you, Teresa, for joining us and answering our questions so fulsomely.
Thank you.
Bye for now.